Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, this is Cliff. If you're enjoying Earth Ancients, let me know. Let others know, too. Leave a review on iTunes. And when you do that, not only do you help let other people know about Earth Ancients. And by the way, it's Earth Ancients, startling new discoveries from our planet's distant past. And you guys know, those of you who have been listening for a while, understand that we're all about ancient Earth's past, known and unknown civilizations. But when you leave a review, you help the show grow by identifying it as a show that people like. And we've been on the air now since 2014. What's that? Almost a half years. And it's great to let others know about the show, but also it helps the show grow, and that's important to me because this has been a labor of love, and the show is basically is well received, and that's great, and I really appreciate that. So, hey, just go to iTunes, click on the station, Earth Ancients, and leave a review. 1 star, 2 star. Well, man, if it's 1 or 2 stars, that's not good. 3 stars would be great. 4 stars is killer. 5 stars is amazing. So leave what you can, leave what you feel you want to, but leave a review. It helps. Okay, here's today's show. We're featuring a new author, Dave Truman, and his discoveries at Tiwanaku, Bolivia, and that is quite a cool place. Saturday, April 1st, 2017. This is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. Hey, I'm really pleased to learn that Earth Ancients is now considered the top podcast on the Blog Talk Radio Network. And thank you for listening. Keep listening. Let your friends know about it. I got to tell you, after years of being a program director at national conferences around the country, Earth Ancients basically came out of my desire to continue the interest, continue the audience growth and understanding of topics from the ancient past, because it affects our present. I think the more we know and understand about the ancient past, we can prepare for the future and actually help our daily lives also. So, to learn that Earth Ancients is the number one history program was kind of fun. And also, as I mentioned before the start of the show, leaving reviews on iTunes helps the program too. And a lot of people are – I mean, we have listeners around the country. And you have to know this, that we do feature the top – authors, best-selling authors, research investigators, and just very knowledgeable individuals, experts in their fields on Earth Ancients. As an example, case in point, I just got a book from a publisher that's a co-written book by Dr. Robert Schock and Robert Bouval. Those are two experts on Egypt. And this new book is called Origins of the Sphinx. It's coming out this summer. And I've just made arrangements to have both Dr. Schock and Robert Bouval come on as my guests in May. And these are, you know, individuals that are very busy, but they enjoy the show. And so we'll have them on. I got to say this too. David Hatcher Childress is coming up. If you don't know David, he's the co-host of Ancient Aliens. We don't promote Ancient Aliens, but he's got a new book on Indonesian pyramids that I thought was quite cool. So we're going to have him. And we're going to have Michael Tellinger back, Graham Hancock, and a number of other people that will be at conferences in Southern California this coming May. There's a big conference called Contact in the Desert, and it's based on some of the work of Eric Von Doniggen, and Graham Hancock's been there a couple of times, but Mike Tellinger's coming out from South Africa. So I'm going to be interviewing a lot of people. So May is going to be filled with some interesting individuals to kind of continue the growth of the program. So really great to know that the program's growing. And let friends know. Let your friends know about Earth Agents. And we're going to continue to feature the best of the best. And I'm really happy, again, to learn that the show is being recognized. So labor of love, and I love what I do. Hey, Earth Ancients is brought to you by Gaia, and this week Gaia is featuring a number of new programs. There's a lot of series of programs that are quite interesting, and if you haven't been to Gaia, remember they're a sponsor, so check them out. The deal is very cool. It's 99 cents for the first month, and after that it's about $9. But the cool thing about Gaia is there's over 7,000 titles. And I think last week I made note that it's probably closer to 7,500. As an example, here's three new shows that have come out. There's a program called Buzzsaw that features parallel civilizations, parallel universes. The theory is that maybe there are other universes that are in different dimensions. And then there's Cosmic Disclosure with Corey Good and Dave Wilcock. And this week they're featuring a series, Time Travel and Technology. Their guess is that the United States is much, much more advanced in their technological achievements in time travel than we've been led to believe. So that's a new series. And then our friend Greg Braden has a series called Missing Links. And this week's program is The Truth About Our Origins. Remember, it's 99 cents. Look, if you don't like it after 1 month, jump off. But 99 cents is very, very reasonable. And hey, it's worth checking out. So to go to the program, to get this deal, go to Gaia, GAIA.com/Earth Ancients, and you'll go to our landing page. And then from there, you'll see a series of really cool pages, really cool programs that have been prepared for you, the audience of Earth Ancients. And then you can jump into the 7,000 titles. And when I say 7,000 titles, it's not one subject. It's like hundreds of subjects. I mean, I'm totally into the pyramids. So they have the foremost authorities on pyramid technology, what we think the pyramids were used for, and ancient history, civilizations known and unknown. It's a perfect, perfect fit for titles, for subject matter here on Earth Ancients. So again, Gaia, GAIA.com/Earth Ancients, and jump into it and check it out. And remember, when you register, they support Earth Ancients. They support what we do here. So, hey, check it out.
Of all the boys I've known, and I've known some.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
And last week I mentioned the PBS special that was created last year called Tiwanaku's Lost Kings. And I have placed it, and it's commercial free. All the promotions have been edited out, and it's no charge. I've placed it on the Facebook page. Facebook Earth Ancients, go to the group page, and you can see the entire program. It's about an hour, but it describes the discovery of a tunnel system that is much more sophisticated than any other system they've ever found. simply because it now appears that they had water passing through there. They channeled water through there. And then there's a number of combinations of chemicals, minerals, and gases that were also introduced into this tunnel that leads directly under the Pyramid of the Serpent at Teotihuacan. I just finished an article that's coming out in April where I hypothesized what this was used for. I think that this is the beginning of our understanding of very old technology. I actually even call it a machine. But this PBS special has just groundbreaking photography of this underground tunnel and the laser scans that came back, the imaging that came back, and then a number of the artifacts are shown in this. The archaeologist Pedro Gonzalez is featured, and he shows us not only the tunnel, but a lot of the interesting interior of this tunnel and cavern. In fact, I reported in this article that they have discovered radon gas being passing through there, which is kind of strange. There's a lot of strange things about this discovery that is fascinating. So, as always, the news segments have articles, photo galleries, surveys, and a lot of other great stuff on the Facebook page. So you go to Facebook, you go to group, you go to the Earth Ancients page, and you'll see all this and a lot more. A large new statue has been unearthed in Egypt, and it seems like every month there's a new statue that has been found. It's almost like something hit that area and dislodged standing statues of magnificently large size, many tons, and just kind of like displaced them, scattered them throughout Egypt. And this is a large statue of Queen Tai, and she's the grandmother of King Amenhotep III, who was a king. And this is a statue that's about 8 feet tall, weighs anywhere between 400 and 600 pounds, and they're still cleaning it up. And it's quite a nice find, and you can see it in its detail on the Facebook page, so check that out. Also, we are continuing with our 360-degree images, and I'm going to have one of the specialists on next week who has a whole website filled with this, but this image that I've placed on the Facebook page is of the Western Wall Foundation in Jerusalem. And this is one of the megaliths of the megaliths of the ancient world that we just don't understand how it was, you know, how it was created. It's very similar to the megaliths we discover in Baalbek, Lebanon, that are part of the temple there. And the actual size of these megaliths is average at 800 tons. I think 800 to 1,000 tons. And the Western Wall Foundation, where this image has been taken, is bigger than that. And I think Zachariah Sitchin in his book, The 12th Planet, describes these megaliths as a supporting feature. But there's no way, there's no clue as to how they were placed in precise order, laid and cut, and to look at it with 360-degree image is very, very cool. And so check that out. And each week we try to put galleries and images of various places around the world on that Facebook page. And that technology continues to grow. And those cameras that shoot that used to be a couple of thousand dollars, but I heard recently that they've come down to a few hundred dollars. And I'll tell you, I'm going to have to get one of them because those images are fantastic. We also have a new 3D scan of Pompeii. And as you know, the story of Pompeii, the city was destroyed by a volcano, but scientists are now able to reconstruct the interior of a lot of the buildings. And this scan was passed in a computer with some programming, and they have completely recreated what Pompeii looked like before it was destroyed. And that is something that is quite interesting to check out. So Earth Ancients is on the Facebook website. Make sure you go to the group page and you can see all these details on Pompeii and so much more. It's really something to consider when you want to know more about the ancient past. And you can see it in whatever form you like, either articles, photo galleries, images, scans. We got a little bit of everything. So check that out. Get inside. So, contributors are a big part of the Earth Ancients Facebook page, and this week we are featuring the work of Ernest Pfeiffer, who is a photographer, he's an amateur archaeologist, and he contributes constant details and information and galleries each week, and I thought I'd have him on. I have had Ernest on the program, not really as a speaker, but more as a kind of background information. But he is a real great contributor. He's also one of the administrators to this Facebook page, and I wanted to talk to him a little bit about his background. It's always fun to add regular contributors to our Earth Ancients Facebook page. And one of the regular contributors, and he's now and has been a administrator of the Earth Ancients page, is Ernest Pfeiffer, who is a United States resident. He actually lives in Florida. And I wanted to have Ernest on the program because not only is he a very fine photographer and has posted a number of his photos on the Facebook gallery, but he's also what I would consider a amateur archaeologist and contributes a great deal to our Facebook page each week. So, hey, Ernest, how you doing today?
Excellent, Cliff. Really good to speak with you again.
Yeah,
how are you doing over there in California?
I'm good in California. Hey, I want to get a little background in our segment today. Tell us a little bit about your interest in history and why it looks like you really like Central America like I do, but you got some South American country too. But talk a little bit about photography from, I think it's the 1990s, where you're in parts of Yucatan and other areas on the peninsula that very, very
good old days.
I remember when I first went to Ekbalam in northern Yucatan, when it was just piles of rocks, and a lot of these ruins, these pyramids, when they find them, which is very curious, by the way, they're just piles of rock, like little mountains that they have to consolidate and reconstruct. But what got you into the photography side of it?
My father, he was a photographer also. He had an old Agfa 35 millimeter camera from the 1950s that was, 100% manual camera, and that was my first camera. So I had to learn all the aspects of lighting and the depth of field, perception, time of day, everything at an early age, because I had to use his camera when we took family pictures.
Right.
So as long as I can remember, I've had a camera in my hand. I even had some of the old box cameras, the 120 film.
Really?
Snap cameras and full format cameras. We had all kinds of cameras.
Okay.
So traveling and taking pictures has always been you know, in my blood, really. My earliest memories are in South America, in the Andes Mountains, riding basically on donkeys, you know, up a hillside to see ruins or, you know, isolated waterfall. We actually have been to the tallest waterfall in the world. I lost the words at the moment to remember the name of it, but it's in Venezuela, all the way up in the mountains. And every chance I got, I spent everything I made to travel.
Wow.
You know,
tell me about your interest in
eco-tourism.
Maya,
yeah.
Yeah, because most of the photographs that you post on the Facebook page are of some spectacular Mayan ruins. Like you got, it's funny because you have photographs where you're visiting the ruins when they actually allowed you to climb the pyramid. Like as an example, Uxmal. Uxmal is one of my
favorite Chichen Itza.
Places. And there was a time, what year was it that you were at Uxmal when you were able to climb it? Was it like 1995 or was it like 2000, early 2000s?
Oh, you're going to laugh. I traveled into those places as a boy. I've traveled in when I was between my junior year and senior year in high school. I dragged two other friends of mine to participate in something. It was a company called Go-Go Tours. They gave you a hotel and the plane fare and meal plan in Cancun for some ridiculous price. It was like $400 a person for like a week. That was in 1984, even before I was out of high school, when I pretty much had my first car and you know, was working part time. I was traveling. And I went to those ruins. So the photos that I've posted on your site, on Earth Ancients, that particular batch, I believe, was from 1993, if I remember correctly, that album.
Okay.
I have so many file cabinets full of prints. I'm from the old days with 35mm film. So
right.
Unfortunately, 99.999% of all my images are locked up in negatives that need to be printed again.
Yeah.
Or some of them were enlarged. And actually sold some of my work way back when I had some connections in the small galleries in Soho in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on getting an image into a gallery in Key West, but I can't say any names because...
Yeah,
it hasn't happened yet.
those are cool.
It's all 35mm format.
What was? Do you remember the last time you were at Uxmal and you actually could climb the pyramid? Because I was there the first time I was there was 1998, and I could climb. I climbed the pyramid.
I was there in 98 also, actually. That's very funny you said that. I was there.
Oh, really?
I was there in September. I believe it was September. It was either June or September.
I came back later in 2005, and they wouldn't let you go up. And the excuse at that time was that it was destabilizing the actual structure, which it was hard to believe. Later, Chichen Itza, which isn't that far away, the city of Chichen, the El Castillo Pyramid, it was open until 2005, and then I learned that some idiot tourists had fallen off the thing.
It's an elderly woman. Yes, she didn't take her breather, and she went backwards.
Oh, you heard the story. Okay. So
I actually made a post about it in Earth's Ancients maybe 2 years ago.
I kind of vaguely remember, but the thing that was interesting, of course, we're talking Mexico, which is a third world country. They don't have the same safety standards that they have here, and it was always amazing to me that to climb Chichen Itza, which is a very steep climb, very small stairway, all they had was like a rope or a chain. And that was
it
in terms
kind
of safety. You held on for dear life.
Yeah. So, well, you know what? Honestly, that's nothing compared to the angle of steepness at Tikal.
If you go
to the Tikal ruins in Guatemala, you will be having a hard time. I actually was walking kind of like I was doing serpentine. Like I would go, I'd start at the bottom to the right hand corner of the staircase and walk to the left, and then I would walk sideways up to the right, and I zigzagged them. That's how I did Chichen Itza. Also, never ever walk straight up. Always kind of, you know, do a serpentine pattern if you're sure of yourself. The chain was there for the elderly and people who you know really needed it. But there were many people at Chichen Itza. Many people had fallen there. Was one of the big fatalities, though. Most people just would break a leg or a shoulder or have a concussion or something. But
Well, I think that one of the problems with that part of the country is that you have the spring break college bunch that busts from Cancun right into Chichen Itza or some of the other things, and well, this is years ago, but I remember seeing this young kid with his buddy rappelling off the side of the observatory, the caracol, the snail, which is the observatory. The guy was on the back of it practicing his mountain rappelling, and I was like, dude, what are you thinking?
I couldn't believe
I was so insane.
It's no wonder. It's no wonder that they want people to stay off of it, because there are a lot of immature jerks, plain and simple, that ruin it for everybody else.
Totally.
Chichen Itza was one of my favorite places to go before they made the rules inoperable for me. I can't go to a place like that and not want to climb them. I was in Palenque in 1998, and as far as back then, you could still walk the ruins of Palenque. There's a couple that are going to be banned soon that I recommend that you get your group of people that you want, you know, your favorites, and take a trip. And maybe give me a call. Maybe we'll go there. You want to go to Nietzsche's, the Pyramid of Nietzsche's, and it's El Tajín.
That's not in Campeche. Yucatan, is it? Yeah, Campeche.
Well, it's Veracruz. It's the Yucatan, but it's on the other side. It's in the Gulf. That is an amazing site that you can still walk around on. You really have to go every year, because they're going to be shutting a lot of them down. Only recently has Mexico become knowledgeable as far as being a country where people use lawyers to sue owners of these parks.
Interesting.
This is what's happening. Like, America has always been controlled by insurance companies going back 100 years at least. You know, you can't walk on a sidewalk without walking on somebody's insurance policy. In Mexico, now that the courts are realizing the profitability of, you know, people suing back and forth, so you're going to see more and more sites that are going to be off limits in the near future. So I really strongly suggest that you get out there. And my advice to everybody listening is, do not get your hotel in Cancun if you want to see Chichen Itza, Etna, Sayil, all of those inner sites, some of the cenotes also. You want to go to a town like Tikal or Merida. You want to be away from all the tourist traps, and you wanted to be able to access the ruins first thing in the morning before all the buses come.
I agree.
You want to be there first.
Hey, listen, Ernest, thank you very much for your contributions to the Earth Ancients page, and I always suggest that people that are listening go to the page to see the latest galleries and things like that. And your galleries are excellent, and your contributions are very timely.
Thank you very much, Cliff.
Keep up the good work, and I appreciate it. And what your focus is perfect for the page. It makes it a really fun page to go to.
It's always been one of the best Facebook pages regarding the subject, and I believe your page was one of the first that I joined, and
right.
long before I decided to have my own pages also that I've,
yeah.
I've been working
yeah.
on. But Earth's
cool.
Ancients has always been number one in my book, and really appreciate being able to say hello to the membership.
Cool. All right, man. Keep up the good work. So Ernest is one of many researchers. He's obviously an amateur archaeologist, but he's a professional photographer. And whenever he puts up a gallery on the Facebook page, it's phenomenal. Some of his early work in the late 1990s, even into the early 2000s, there are detailed looks at a number of Mayan sites throughout Central America. And boy, I mean, it's just, he's a real pro. He uses a lot of old equipment, as he mentioned. So again, each week we try to have a spotlight on one of our contributors. Everyone's got a story to tell. I always think it's kind of cool to check that out. Tiwanaku has been a subject on this program for a number of months, if not years. Today's program is Tiwanaku, Ancient City of the Gods, and we're featuring a new author, Dave Truman, who has a new book coming out in the fall. And over the years, we've had people like Chris Dunn, who's an author engineer, talk about the importance of Tiwanaku's precision. Talks about precision. He is talking about how these megalithic stones, the floors, the walls, pillars were cut with an unknown science. We don't have any technology that can determine how these megalithic blocks that weigh sometimes as much as 440 tons were cut. In his book, author John Burke describes how the stone, which is andesite, is also a conductor, an electricity conductor, electromagnetic frequency conductor. We don't know how that was used. We don't have any clue how this place was constructed and by whom. So this new book by Dave Truman is fascinating, and I had a chance to talk to him as he had just returned from Bolivia. Deal of interest in South America, not only because there are ancient cities there that date to what I would call the pre-flood period. But also, there's a great deal of curiosity about the inhabitants of a number of cities. We've talked and had authors on our program that have spoken about Cusco, Sacsayhuaman, and a number of cities that are in the Peruvian or the Cusco area that are extremely old, and the inhabitants were megalithic builders. They built cities and walls using huge stones, in some cases very highly precisely cut stones. And then we've talked also about Bolivia and Tiwanaku, which is quite a fabulous city. I haven't had a chance to get there yet, but we've had a few people talk about it. But a couple of months ago, I read quite a fascinating article that was on Graham Hancock's website. And the author was a gentleman named Dave Truman. And the article was called Ancient Alignment in the Andes hints at a lost global culture. And the article is very well written. And one of the reasons that I wanted to get in touch with Dave is that he has also written about quite a well-known early archaeologist, a guy named Arthur Poznanski. And Poznanski is very critical in the discussion. I should say he's very important in the discussion of Tiwanaku because his early dates, based on celestial alignment, show that, according to him, the city has an inception date of 15,000 BC. That's over 17,000 years ago, which is, you know, extremely old by any account. Now, I'm going to have Dave on here in a second, but I also want you to think that about that date. Conventional science has a real problem with those dates. In fact, Poznanski got in a great deal of trouble with his contemporaries in the scientific community because that date is doesn't come close to the current academic historic point of view of when advanced cultures were populating that part of the world. In fact, there's really no place on Earth that has dates that go back that far. So anyhow, I wanted to get a hold of Dave and talk a little bit about his research and learn about his discovery. So, hey, Dave, great to have you on the program.
Yeah.
How are you?
Yeah, it's nice to be on. Thanks for asking me. Yeah.
Now, we have to,
I don't know whether
prep.
You want...
oh. Go ahead. What?
No, I was just, whether you wanted me to sort of say something about the astronomical dating of Tiwanaku first.
Oh, we're definitely going to talk about that. We want to talk about... Poznanski's work, and we want to talk about your other discoveries. But you just got back from Bolivia. What kind of a flight time is that? I think you left. I think you said you left from Lima. But what is it? What is its flight time to get back to the UK? That's a monster.
Well, I've only just started a direct flight to from London to Lima and back again, and it's a 12-hour flight coming from Peru to Britain.
Okay, and that's a direct flight? That's pretty good.
Yeah, it's not bad. It's still quite a long journey, though.
I know. I was just reminiscing a few weeks ago. I flew from San Francisco to Paris, and it was equally long. I don't do well on flights, so the jet lag took some time to adjust to. So, but you were just there, and were you specifically in Bolivia, or were you all over the place?
Well, actually, you mentioned the article I wrote for Graham about just over a year ago. I was actually finishing off some field research I was doing for that, the book that's a sort of extended version of that article. So I was traveling along the Great Alignment that I write about in that article, the Northwest-Southeast Alignment, which just happens to take me along the path of Tiwanaku, Cusco, including Sacsayhuaman, Ollantaytambo, right up to Cajamarca in the north of Peru, which was before I went back to Lima. That was the last city I visited.
What is your interest in these ancient sites? Do you have a background in research, or are you just a curiosity seeker? You're seeking, like I am, of ancient cultures who, in many cases, have not been correctly reviewed.
Well, my background is curiosity, really. As you implied, I've just been really curious about the Andes and the ancient sites there ever since I first visited them in, I think it was the year 2000. And I was on an organized tour. I went to Cusco, and it was strikingly obvious to me that the great polygonal megalithic structures that are the lowest levels of some of the buildings in Cusco the large stones, and then the even larger polygonal stones at places like Sacsayhuaman and in Ollantaytambo as well, were not the same building technology as the square stones and rather smaller stones that the Incas used. And they always occurred in the same order. The lowest level were the largest stones and the most complex interlocking stones. Then you had the square stones, and then on top of that, in some of the buildings in Cusco that are still standing and being used today, you had the Spanish level of construction on the top. And that just prompted my curiosity even further. And then I started reading more and more. I'd already been, I'd already read things like Fingerprints of the Gods, so I was open to the idea that there was possibly the existence of quite highly sophisticated societies with sophisticated technologies for construction and for things at a very early date.
Now, your articles are very well written. I read a new article on Poznanski that I thought was excellent. I've always thought that he was poorly treated by the academic community simply because he came up with dates for Tiwanaku that are not, according to them, legitimate. But let's just preface this interview by letting people know that you have a book that's coming out called The Lost Science of the Andes. And if it has any of the same quality of the writing that I've seen in these articles, it's going to be a very, very interesting and good read. So let's talk about this article on Poznanski, and tell us a little bit about what you know about this gentleman. He's fascinating, he's brilliant, and he spent the better part of his life studying Tiwanaku. I think people need to know about him. So why don't you tell us about him, why he's important?
I mean, he is a very, very interesting character. He was actually an engineer by profession, not an archaeologist, which I think is interesting as well.
Yeah.
From several points of view. And although I knew of his ideas indirectly through writers like Graham Hancock about the dating of Tiwanaku, until I actually read Poznanski myself in his Cradle of American Civilization, for example, I didn't realize that he didn't just look at the archaeological sites and excavate them. And he did that in a very methodical way, by the way. He's one of the first people to excavate Tiwanaku properly, rather than, you know, treasure hunting or just sort of casually digging in the ground. He did it very carefully and methodically. But he was also involved in looking at the language of the native peoples there, their writing, because they did have writing, it's just not widely disseminated, and also the geology of the Andes, which plays an enormous part in the wider interpretation and supports the evidence of his astronomical dating, that early astronomical date. He did lots of excavations on the Altiplano around Tiwanaku and in Tiwanaku itself. For example, he says that he dug beneath the Acapana Pyramid, which just looks like a mound of earth today, but in its heyday it was a seven-step pyramid. And he dug beneath that and he found evidence of an earlier mound. And within that he found what he calls a fossilized skeleton with an elongated, well, we presume it was an elongated head, although he says deformed. And he quite explicitly says it's fossilized, and it's in a stratum where another geologist had been digging nearby. Mm-hmm. So he equated with a stratum that another geologist had dug nearby in the Desert Guadero River. And this stratum, he reckons, Poznanski reckons, is from the Pleistocene. It's from the Ice Age. So this skeleton,
ice period,
is from the Ice Age. We know that that stratum was probably from that era because the other archaeologist, whose name I can't recall at the moment, he actually found the names of toxodons in that stratum. And toxodon was one of the megafauna in South America that died out at the end of the Ice Age about 9,500 years ago.
Let me just highlight that point, because this is very interesting, and I didn't know this about him. It was is The Toxodon is a small mammal. It looks like a little, I wouldn't say buffalo, but it's very woolly, and it's low to the ground, and it's an ice age. It's kind of the last of the, would you call it a dinosaur?
No, it's later than that. It's in North America.
Yeah.
About
right.
71% of the large mammals died out in this period, and nobody really understands why without a catastrophe as a hypothesis. Toxodon was one of the South American large mammals that died out at the same period, along with the saber-toothed tiger as well, which is also interesting when we come to Poznanski.
The thing I want to just mention is that the Toxodon lived between 2.5 million years ago, and then they think that they became extinct about 10,000 years ago. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah. Nine and a half, ten. Can't be exact.
And then here we are finding this skeletal remains embedded in this mound, which is kind of a real giveaway, wouldn't you think?
It wasn't in the mound. It was in a level, a stratum under the ground that equated with where Poznanski had found this human skeleton.
Oh, right. Okay. Oh, yeah. Right. Very good. Okay.
That's a date.
Yeah. Amazing. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say the other animal that dates from that Pleistocene, the Ice Age era, that Poznanski suggests might actually be depicted on some of the bas relief carvings at Tiwanaku is the Smilodon, the saber-toothed cat that lived in the Andes in that period as well, and also died out. Because he did note that some of the what are generally thought to be pumas have incredibly long teeth, fangs at the front, which is a characteristic of obviously the earlier cats and the much larger cats that lived in that part of the Andes during the Ice Age. So it's another little piece of, I suppose, circumstantial evidence that points towards an early date for Tiwanaku as well.
For those who are not familiar with Tiwanaku, it is a ancient city that's in Bolivia, very, very high up. I think the elevation is it 10,000 or 9,000 feet above sea level?
12,000.
Extremely 12,000 high up.
Yeah.
And what makes Tiwanaku such a curiosity to scientists and individuals, investigative research individuals, is that close by, there are megalithic stones that are cut with extreme precision, and that's in Pumapuku, which is right next door. And the pyramid complex has a great deal of precision built into it. The people who built this place were very focused on mathematics and engineering and high levels of construction. And more important, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about this, Dave, is that the city has a specific alignment. And Poznanski used this early form of archaeoastronomy to date the city. So tell us a little bit about that, why it makes it so important that this archaeoastronomy figure is such a detail.
Well, because the date he derived from his observations and calculations based on those observations was very early, as you've already mentioned, and lots of people have criticized this. But in fact, Poznanski was using exactly the same methodology that Norman Lockyer had used previously in Egypt and Greece, and later, I think, with Stonehenge as well in his career, to derive astronomical dates for the construction of these sites. And Poznanski adapted it. He looked at one part of the Tiwanaku complex, which is called the Kalasasaya Temple, and he looked at the cornerstones, and he basically took measurements of the sunrise at the solstice at two of the cornerstones and noticed that they seemed to be different from the current position of the cornerstones. And he used a calculation which is based on the change in the Earth's tilt over time, which is said to be very steady and slow and almost like a sort of a celestial clock. The Earth's tilt changes over, I think it's a 6,000-year cycle, I can't recall precisely, very gradually. But that obviously changes the point at which the sun appears to rise over the horizon, and you can count back to the, from the present tilt of the Earth to and achieve a date. And that's how, essentially, he achieved his 15,000 BC date. And it's often quoted and used in isolation. But in his own time, it was controversial. The academic archaeologists did not like this date.
Yeah.
For reasons that are probably too obvious to state.
But, you actually wrote something in your article, Dave, that I thought was funny. The contemporary scientists of the day, I guess they flew out from Germany or somewhere. I can't remember what you said.
That's right. There was a whole team of astronomers who came out and studied, took their own measurements and studied Poznanski's work for a period of 3 months in Bolivia.
Yeah. And they, but they came out with a very old date too, wasn't it? 9600 BC.
It was pretty old. Basically, which is curious because that date now is considered just about when the Earth is supposed to have warmed up after the 1500-year Younger Dryas Big Freeze at the end of the Ice Age. So their sort of corrected date of Poznanski, although it's not quite as old as ancient, it's still very ancient. And it does correspond almost exactly to when most most geologists who support the Younger Dryas theory say it actually finally ended, which I think is fascinating. But there have also been other people who've checked Poznanski's figures. There was Professor Neil Steed, I think in the 90s, who went over Poznanski's figures, took his own measurements, and came up with a date of 12,000 years before present, or 10,000 years BC, which, again, seems to tally. But I think the most interesting of all, from the point of view of just the controversy of it, was the very senior Bolivian archaeologist called Oswaldo Rivera, who, again, in the 90s, he said he was going to. He worked alongside Neil Steve for a while. Anyway, they had sort of joint visits to the site. But he said he was going to check it. He says because he didn't believe it. He said it's far too early. And he not only took the sunrise positions, the difference in the measurement of the sunrise according to the tilting of the Earth, but he looked at the sunsets as well. So he checked all four cornerstones. The Kalasasaya temple, which is rectangular, essentially. And they all tallied. They all tallied, and they all came in with a comparable date of around 10,000 years ago, again.
Yeah.
So we're in this time zone with all of this astronomical dating. And Poznanski's original work, okay, it was a few thousand years out of kilter, but the modern researchers, such as Neil Steed and Oswaldo Rivera, had the benefit of sort of NASA data, satellite information and things like that, so they could hone in the figures much more accurately than Poznanski could. Obviously, in those days, they didn't have that sort of kind of accurate data to measure celestial movements and so on. And yet the dates are remarkably consistent. I think that's worthy of further investigation at the very least, but it still gets written off.
Well, it's one of those... And we've talked to a number of people that have been there. It's definitely an anomalous location for numerous reasons. I mean, when you look at the stonework, the floors, the walls, the supports, they look like they're poured cement from cement. And yet we've had engineers like Christopher Dunn there who have verified that they're cut in some manner. They don't know how, but they're cut with a level of precision that would take extremely modern tools, maybe tools that are beyond our current technology. You know, I mean, it's like a truly lost civilization that's using a science that hasn't been conceived of yet.
No. I mean, personally, I don't think that the domes at Tiwanaku and Pumapunku are any form of concrete. I mean, it's been pretty well established now that they are actually grey andesite.
Andesite is
mined on the Copacabana Peninsula, about 12 miles to the north on the edge of Lake Titicaca. Yeah. But andesite is a very, very interesting geological stone, basically. It contains lumps of, and that andesite does contain lumps of magnetite, and that has led me along a whole different path of investigation to do with Tiwanaku and the, I suppose you'd call it the displacement of the magnetic fields there. A fascinating subject.
Well, let's talk about that. In your article, Ancient Alignment in the Andes, Hints at a Lost Global Culture, you actually did some interesting tests with compass. And what did you find on the magnetic fields that were quite unique?
Well, I'll start with an anecdote of it, because it wasn't really I who found it. I bumped into two French people, I think it was 2011 or 2012, who were when I was at Tiwanaku, and they were wandering around with this compass, and it turned out that they, funnily enough, were, or at least one of them was, some kind of aeronautical engineer. They were sort of looking at various parts of the site and looking at the compass and seeing if there was any variation. And we went to Pumapunku. I sort of teamed up with them. We walked around. We were chatting. We went to Pumapunku. And one of them moved the compass he had next to a piece of grey andesite. It had an Andean cross marked into it, carved into it. And the direction of the compass just shifted automatically from magnetic north to 45 degrees magnetic northwest, like that. And we started chatting. We thought it was a bit strange. Tried it again. It kept happening.
Mm.
Anyway, it's getting rather late, and they had to get back to Peru. They'd done a day's journey from the Peruvian border to get there. And I sort of noted it. I thought, oh, that's quite interesting. And I went back the next year with my own compass and spent a bit longer at various pieces of andesite. And I went to this other part, not Pumapunku, but a part called the Cantatarita, which is a very interesting place that was actually being excavated over 2 or 3 years ago. But the Cantatarita, there are two large pieces of grey andesite there with chicanas marked into them. And I noticed that they were changing the orientation of the magnetic field when I moved the compass next to them. Anyway, around the back of one of these pieces, there is a diamond-shaped piece of magnetite stuck in there, and I still can't tell whether it was made and inserted in or whether it's just a piece occurring naturally in the rock. But at one point during this particular visit, I pushed the compass next to it, and it suddenly started spinning in an anti-clockwise direction.
Yeah.
Now, I've taken lots of, I wouldn't say there were measurements because I'm not using precision instruments here, but I've been back loads of times, and this particular piece of magnetite does change the orientation of the magnetic field, but always in calibrated almost in differences of 45 degrees. So one time it'll be at 45 northwest, and it'll be at 90 degrees pointing west. Then it might be at 180 degrees pointing sort of south or southeast. Yeah. And occasionally, when it seems to happen around electrical storms, that the effect of the magnetic variation builds up during this period. But whoever, you know, those pieces of magnetite were known about by the people who built Tiwanaku, I'm absolutely certain. I'm far less certain about what use it was being put to, but I have some ideas.
Well, I don't know if you've read anything by John Burke. He was an American scientist that actually used measuring tools, magnometers and things like that, and he was at Tiwanaku and measured those areas, and he measured the stones and got very similar readings, in fact, but he got very high readings at certain types of during the morning hours, and then as the day waned on, they seemed to decrease. So it was almost like a natural, I don't know if it was because of the sun or because these underground telluric fields were at their height as the sun rose or the morning began. But go ahead.
Well, so I was just going to say, I'm convinced. I read Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty a couple of years ago, and he does mention actually the Akapana Pyramid, the very pyramid that we've just been talking about in Tiwanaku. Mm-hmm. I'm absolutely certain that they were engineering telluric currents in some way. They were using the natural faults in the earth, the geology, because you must remember that the Andes is absolutely full of metallic minerals, the whole of that part of the Andes is particularly. Mm-hmm. And they were using the natural conductivity of the earth in some way. They were actually diverting water channels to focus, to focus the natural electric currents, the telluric currents, in certain areas, possibly around pyramids as well, actually. Another site that I visited is Chavin de Huántar in Peru, which is, they say that it was earlier than Tiwanaku, but I think actually it was probably influenced by Tiwanaku, because I believe Poznanski was basically right with the early date there. And there, they built the site at the confluence of two rivers. And they built water channels underneath the site, and there was similar sorts of engineering taking place in Tiwanaku as well. Poznanski mentioned the docks there and the other things that seem to indicate that there were water channels there, and the city has been flooded over the years.
Let's think about this for a minute, because I remember in John Burke's book, he does talk about his belief that there was channels that were designed into the pyramid complex, and that the water was a conductor of some kind. If you were to, and the thing about John is he was such a scientist, and although he was uncovering very radical information about how the ancients may have channeled and collected electromagnetic energy, he never gave a for instance. In fact, one of the things that was very frustrating about him is he goes to the World Pyramid in Tikal, Guatemala, and his belief is they built this monstrosity of a pyramid to cultivate crop seeds. Too bad he passed on, because I was going to say, John, I mean, come on, this is thousands of man hours to build these complexes, and then to resort to just propagating seeds. And he did show that the seeds were that had the energy pass through them were greatly enhanced, and they could grow corn that high yields, very hardy stalks, very unusual, powerful, healthy food crops. But my feeling is that they probably use it for a number of things. What do you say? I want to ask you, Truman, what do you say?
You've touched on a very live area of my research at the moment, actually. I think they almost certainly were used to stimulate germination, yes. But, recently I read a book called... I think it's Shamanism in the Pyramid Texts. Have you seen that book?
It's called Shamanism in the Pyramid Text.
Yeah, Sacred Shamanism in the Pyramid Text. I've just got it. Hold on a second. Yeah, it's by Shamanic Wisdom in the Pyramid Text. It's called, and it's by Jeremy Nadler. Now, it seems on the face of it to have nothing at all to do with John Burke's work. But what Nadler's saying is that the pyramid texts that on the inside of the Zoser Pyramid in Egypt, for example, weren't simply funerary texts. They were used. Most archaeologists, Egyptologists, think that they were interpretations of the funerary text, the afterlife journey of the dead pharaoh. But Nadler puts forward the idea that during the Hebsed festival in Egypt, these texts were actually to enable the pharaoh, while he was still alive in his physical body, to journey into realms beyond what materialists would call reality, let's say. It was a sort of development from earlier shamanism. And what's interesting about it is that the purpose of this exercise, which took place in a chamber in a pyramid, say Zoser's pyramid and over that period of the early dynastic Egypt, was to secure the fertility of the land. Yes? This was the this was the ultimate purpose of the ceremony and of the wealth and benefits endowed upon Egypt for the future period. In essence, that function is no different from creating more fertile seeds inside a pyramid, say, in South America. So what I'm trying to drive at is here that possibly what we're looking at are the remnants of a much more ancient technology, one that John Burke rediscovered part of the function of through the seed fertilization and growth. But we see it through things like the pyramid texts in Egypt as well. Does that make sense?
Well, the thing I'm trying to get at, though, is that these early cultures understood human physiology in a way that we do not understand. And I know this because I practice yoga and meditation, and those are very ancient techniques. And whoever understood and developed yoga understood the details of not only physiology but also the connection between mind, body, and perhaps spirit. Because when you do certain positions, it triggers hormones and enzymes and things like this to move and to react in a certain way, and they're beneficial. There's still a lot we don't know about how yoga works, but there's a lot we don't know about our own bodies. Most of us are focused on medical technology, which is pretty much an analysis of what the disease process is in the body, and not how the body heals itself and how it, you know, I mean, there, we do know how, you know, there's certain functions, but on a subtle energy level, we know nothing. And it's my understanding that these very, very old cultures, the ones that built the early Mayan pyramids in Teotihuacan and Tiwanaku and even in Egypt, they understood a level of subtle energy, and they imbued the body, I believe, with some of this energy that comes out of these pyramids. I mean, Burke talks a little bit about the World Pyramid in Tikal, but the other thing is, I don't even think it's all that either. I think that's one application, the body, and we just talked about the crops. But they must have been, you know, using this energy for other things too. If it's vehicles, if it's devices, if it's equipment of some kind, I don't know. But I'm just curious about if you have any, if you've even thought about that.
Well, I agree. I think the issue for me is that some of it certainly was to do with the healing properties of the pyramids, or the way that the pyramids might be able to heal individuals. But they also had many other applications as well. I think it's a very modern way of thinking to think that a pyramid, for the sake of argument, or a temple had a single function. I think they did have multiple functions. I mean, there's a whole... I went to another site, which is on this great alignment up in the north of Peru, just before I came back to England, and it's called Cumbe Mayo. Now, this again, I think, uses these subtle energies, as you call them. I think it's to do with a lost aspect of physics, personally, which is the ether that we've lost sight of since general relativity came along. And I think the ancient people actually understood something about this that we don't understand. And it's the linkage between the physical universe and the non-physical. But in Cumbe Mayo, what's interesting about this site is that it's a series of channels, water channels, that have been cut into rock. And water's been diverted from a natural stream to run through all these different shaped channels. And... it's curious because the standard explanation is, oh, they used it for irrigation or the fields. But the artificial channels run in exactly the same direction, basically, as the natural river that water's been diverted from. So that can't have been the case. And in certain places, the people who built this site actually cut a piece of granite into a circle. A large block of granite, they worked it into the form of a circle. Then they cut the water channel through the middle of it. Now, if you were just to irrigate the land, you'd do it the easiest way possible. You'd make a channel so that it flowed around a large stone. You wouldn't cut it through the middle. But what was interesting about this, I took a few photographs of this. I've been there a few times. And the water that flows through this stone in the channel suddenly develops a kind of standing wave pattern. Whereas the water on either side, the surface of it is flat. So there's something going on, some kind of interaction taking place between this piece of rock and the water that's flowing through. And I think they had some kind of knowledge of how energy and movement, impetus, was transferred from one physical medium to another through something else that probably underpins them both.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, there's just so much we don't know.
And the other interesting thing about this site is it's actually situated at the watershed of the Andes. So one side of the site, the water flows down into the Pacific. On the other side, it flows into the Amazon basin. And they happened to construct this site just there. Now, how did they know that? Could have been through, obviously, observation. But why would they do that? There's something that they're doing something with the water in... that we don't quite understand is what I'm driving at. I'm not sure I understand it, but it's raising very interesting questions about the way they thought and how they used technology.
Yeah, I'm running into the same problem. I'm currently writing an article about the pyramid in Tiwanaku. It's the serpent, Pyramid of the Serpent.
Mm-hmm.
And they have discovered channels that were cut or built into the mechanism of the pyramid itself that run deeply underground, about 100 feet underground. Mm-hmm. And there's pyrite that's been coated on the walls. They found mercury. They found that they had radon gas passing through there. And in this canal, there are little small rooms, which it's like it's a reactor of some kind of combustion is created to create energy. But that's just off the top of my head. I don't have a clue because it's a science we don't know. But what you're telling me is quite fascinating when I hear about this water, because water plays a huge part in these Central American pyramids too. So it's quite interesting. I want to ask you about part of this article you wrote, Ancient Alignments in the Andes. I think they're called Chicana.
Oh, the Chicana, yeah.
Yeah, and Can you talk a little bit about Viracocha too? Because that entity, that individual, seems to be the giver of knowledge. But I'm curious about this, the second part of this article on the sacred number and advanced geometry.
Yes. Well, I mean, that was really, I came to those realizations through reading other authors when I started off. I mean, most of my research in the first couple of years was simply by reading other people like John Michel, as I mentioned, Graham Hancock as well, and a few others more recently, I think Scott Onsott. And these numbers keep popping up all over the place. They occur in sacred texts. They occur in the dimensions and measurements of various ancient sites and even medieval cathedrals and what have you. You know, they're all over the place. And it was when I was looking at the, in the sort of European tradition, the sacred geometry of squaring the circle and what was involved with that, I suddenly noticed that actually the geometry of the Chicana is based on the same model, essentially, that there is a common grounding for both what's been going on in South America and what's been going on in remote times in the Middle East and in Europe as well. I mean, one example I think I just touch on there that I think is quite interesting is the geometry of the Chicana, the Andean cross, which is an equal-armed Andean cross, but it's sometimes formed called a stepped cross. And there can be different numbers of steps. But in the one that I feature in that article, it's actually got sort of four ends to the arms of the cross, equal armed. And then there's other right angles in between those. So it makes a total of 12 points going round in a circle. And that geometry, essentially, is based on something called the Pythagorean constant, which is if you have a square and you draw a diagonal line across the square, if the units of each side of the square are, say, one unit, then the diagonal will always be the Pythagorean constant, which is the square root of 2. It works out at 1.414235, etc. What's interesting about the Pythagorean constant is it's one of a series of numbers that are mathematical constants. They're like pi, like phi, there are others as well. And they basically go on to infinity, they don't resolve. And ancient sites seem to use these particular numbers a lot. I mean, most people probably know about the Great Pyramid involving pi and phi geometry and its dimensions. But the Pythagorean constant was used by the Egyptians as well. I can't remember which way round it is, but the royal cubit and the ramen, which are two measurements that the Egyptians used, are based on the Pythagorean constant. One is 1.4, whatever it is, and the other is 1. And we find this same constant in the geometry that was used in South America, in the Chicana as well, which is, you know, I find absolutely fascinating. There's a Peruvian researcher called Carlos Milena Videna, and he came up with the idea that the early South Americans discovered this constant through looking at the Southern Cross, because the Southern Cross is, obviously, it's a cross, but it's not the length, the dimension of the length between the upper star and the bottom star is in a certain proportion to the cross piece, the two stars that form the cross piece, and this happens to be the Pythagorean constant as well. And the same, that geometry, that mathematical constant was used throughout, as well as pi as well, according to Milena Villena. So we've got these same underpinning geometric patterns and systems that we call perhaps today sacred geometry being used in South America as much as they were in Egypt, early Britain, etc., etc., etc. I find that fascinating. And that, to me, suggests Well, it suggests some kind of perhaps a priori sort of platonic knowledge of geometry that's part of the human psyche, but it also may suggest cultural contacts between different parts of the world at very early times as well.
Yeah, I was actually going to suggest that because you do in your article subscribe to the potential exchange of knowledge with the Sumerians, which is a very old, old culture in the Mesopotamia area, Middle East. Do you subscribe to the possibilities of some form of cultural exchange, technology exchange? We had a well-known academic archaeologist who discusses that, Dr. Richard Hansen, who's in Guatemala excavating El Mirador, which is an ancient Mayan site. And he actually wrote an article with probably one of the foremost authorities on Mayan culture, Michael Cole, who now is 86. And in his article, Cole says that he believes that there was technology exchange between the Maya and Indonesian cultures simply because of their structures and a lot of relief work that he's discovered, which I find quite fascinating to consider and pretty amazing, meaning that there was some kind of Pacific travel of some kind. But what do you think?
You mentioned Viracocha earlier, and I think that's probably Viracocha may be an amalgam of several different figures. I think there is a sort of mythic Viracocha, but there was certainly, in some of the legends, at least according to the Spanish chroniclers, Viracocha probably did come from somewhere else and probably did try to help out at a critical period in Andean prehistory after a major cataclysm. But I also think that there were probably later contacts, and there is evidence, and there is good physical evidence for contact with, not Sumeria necessarily, but certainly what's termed Proto-Sumeria or Proto-Sumerian-speaking peoples, because there are artifacts that have been found in the Andes that are, have cuneiform script on them, imprinted into the clay of a bowl, for example. But it's not, it's Proto-Sumerian, it's before that. It's about 3,100 BC, according to this bowl called the Fuente Magna, that's actually in the Museum of Precious Metals in La Paz. They won't put it in the archaeological museum. and it has Proto-Sumerian writing on it, cuneiform script in the Proto-Sumerian language, which is very interesting because now the dates are going back and back now in the Andes for civilization anyway. I mean, that would be around before 3000 BC. They've now found up in the north of Peru several cities that were built around 3500 BC. And these cities had circular pyramids, basically. In tiers, step pyramids, but they were circular, rather like some of the early ones up in Central America, actually, which is interesting. But the Sumerian connection, I think, is interesting as well from the point of view of the use of numbers and so on, because so much of the symbolism that I've come across in the early statuary that I've found as well does bear a resemblance to the numerological systems and the geometry, as I was saying before, with the Chicana as well. So I definitely think there was a contact. I mean, even the Acapana pyramid was originally a stepped pyramid with seven steps, and it had a Chicana-shaped, it was a truncated pyramid with a Chicana-shaped pool of water on the top, which reflected the stars above. Now, seven-step pyramids are reminiscent, to say the least, of ziggurats in Sumeria. I just think there are too many sort of connections like that that can't just be written off as mere coincidence. They doesn't resemble a ziggurat because its design is actually more complicated if you look at it in plan form. But having seven steps suggests some kind of maybe technological usage that we, again, going back to what we were saying before, we may not quite understand today.
Yeah. It's, you know, there's just so much lost to us. It's we had Michael Cremo on the program last week, and he was talking about the yugas, which help us understand the cyclic nature of civilization. You know, the start goes to civilization will start, it grows to a high level, and then through either natural causes or through their own self-extermination, they're destroyed, and then it starts up again. You know, this goes over, according to Hindu Vedas, the Vedic traditions, millions and millions of years. Well, most conventional science say we can't see that. We're going to not accept that. But yeah, when you see these ancient sites like Tiwanaku and this level of sophistication built into their stoneworks, where there's a property that channels and carries electromagnetic energy, which means that these buildings were alive with energy. Who knows? Mm. Who knows what level of sophistication they are? I mean, I was talking to some elders 20 years ago in the Yucatan, and they told me flat out that a lot of the buildings at Sayel, which is on the, it looks like a Roman column. A lot of these buildings are imbued with knowledge in the stone. Mm. I mean, it's just a whole level we can't even conceive of. And even to talk about it, a few years ago, people will look at you like you're crazy. But I think
I think
when we get technology that can measure and extract the information, then it becomes realized. So.
Yeah, well, maybe it is linked in with the yugas. I think it is, actually, because you know, you refer to it. And I think these structures, certainly the oldest of them, were probably built in a time when it was a different yuga. And the technology wasn't necessarily to create something physical in the sense that we in our current yuga, our current age, would understand. Yeah? It might have been something to do with energy flows that we can't maybe appreciate quite as much today because we're living in a more dense world. I know we're supposed to be coming out of the Kali Yuga, and I think a lot of the developments in the 20th century in science probably reflect that as well, you know, use of electricity and then, you know, looking at the quantum physics as well. You start to move out of the purely physical, tangible world and realize that reality is much greater than that. I think these ancient people had an understanding that we've lost, essentially. Maybe we're just starting to get it back again now.
I agree. One last question, and then I'm going to let you go. This has been real fun, Dave. You're in the UK. You're calling today from someplace close to London.
Liverpool, actually.
Oh, you're in Liverpool. Okay, good.
Yeah, just outside, yeah.
Excellent. Do you see any patterns in the engineering of these, or even the cutting of these stones in Bolivia and in Peru, that have any similarity to any of the other places that you've visited in, say, either the Middle East or any place else in the European basin?
I can only really talk about Britain because I've never been to Egypt and South America. I will say, I think, that from what I've seen in South America, I think the polygonal stones, the megaliths, large stones that you see at places like Sacsayhuaman and other places, is a different technology from what you see in Pumapunku, for example. Yeah. So there's a difference there. Now, whether that's because one's earlier than the other or later, or they were completely different cultures, I don't know, essentially. But generally, I think the working of the finest stones, that megaliths that I've seen in South America, compared with what's in Britain in general, I mean, it's much finer work. It's much finer work than you'd see in a site like Stonehenge, for example, and certainly somewhere like Avebury. But that doesn't mean, you know, in some ways that doesn't mean to say that maybe the function of the stones here was different. Maybe they functioned in a different way with the energies that we've just been talking about. I mean, there are some similarities that I've seen between the what are called the metallic clamps in the stones, for example. You get them at Ollantaytambo in Peru, Pumapunku in Tiwanaku in Bolivia. Some people draw comparisons between those and some of the clamps in places, I think it's the El Sarion in Egypt and other places, the megalithic sites there. I have a rather different view on that personally, because if you look at the shape of those so-called clamps in Egypt, they're actually two triangular shapes that have been pushed together. And I think their primary purpose is for clamping the stones together, holding them tight. Whereas I think the ones in South America are for electromagnetic purposes rather than structural strength and reinforcement. Yeah, because the shape's different. They're eye-shaped. I don't think that's the optimum shape. But also, if you look at the composition of the metals as well, there's some very interesting features to how they made the bronze for the bronze clamps at Tiwanaku, which are fascinating. And I think there they were used for ensuring flow of electromagnetic currents through the stone structures, because they're always in andesite, which is always rich in magnetite, as I said before.
Yeah. Wow. That's a, you know, I kind of in the back of my head thought about those clamps, and we don't have enough people talking about them, but, you know, you find clamps at in buildings that are a few thousand years old, which makes you think maybe this technology was known up until fairly recent. Well, recent, you know, a couple thousand years ago, which should be interesting to consider. Yeah.
Well, I've seen a similar clamp to the ones in Egypt in a wall near me, actually, in the city of Chester, and on a bridge. It's reinforcing a bridge, and it's only a couple of hundred years old. So it's a function. The triangular intersecting triangles is definitely a functional structure to reinforce the structure itself, the stone structure. But like I said, with the ones in Bolivia and Ollantaytambo, I don't think that was their main purpose. Because actually, you get them in all sorts of odd shapes as well. These metal or the cavities for these metal shapes. You see them in curved shapes. You see them in just rectangular shapes as well. In which case, they're not holding two stones together. They're being used for conductivity purposes.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, hey, Dave Truman, it's been great speaking with you. I am going to post, with your permission, this article, Ancient Alignment in the Andes, Hints at a Lost Global Culture, on the Facebook page. And
thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, no, I think it's very well written, and it's a great read. And when can we expect this book, The Lost Science of the Andes, to come out? And what's the time frame, do we know?
Well, I'm hoping to get it in some kind of final shape towards the end of this year.
Okay.
A lot of questions about how I publish it and where I publish it and so on, but I'll let you have a copy anyway, Cliff.
Fantastic. Yeah, no, your writing is, like I said, it flows really nicely, and you've got some great research in this work, so much success to you.
Thank you.
So that was Dave Truman, and I have placed the article on the Facebook page, Ancient Alignment in the Andes, Hints at a Global High Culture, and it's got a lot of really interesting graphs on there, and I place it at the very top of the page. So you can get you can see it right away. You don't have to dig too far into the Facebook page. So you got to go to Facebook, Earth Ancients. Go to the group page. I've placed it on both the international and the group page, so you can see it pretty quickly. So, Lots to discuss regarding Tiwanaku. And I think it's just going to be one of those situations that as our technology grows, as our science begins to develop scanning tools and devices to unlock properties within stone and buildings and things like that, we're going to discover there's a whole level of science that we just do not have the ability to comprehend. And authors like Dave Truman and many, many others are trying to figure out what the story is here, but it's fascinating to even consider that prehistoric people were able to conceive of these ideas and develop a science that is totally of a different paradigm. So fascinating. Okay, well, that's it for today's show. I want to remind you that next week we have a fascinating subject on ancient medicine and how it is relates to today's story. How we deal with illness today is a huge fascination of mine. It has been for years, and I have a lot of physicians on in my family that have had their natural healing abilities kind of drummed out of them to get their degrees. And academic science has a lot of benefits to what they do, but there's a lot of things that are left out. And our author next week has written a book called The Science of Planetary Signatures in Medicine, Restoring the Cosmic Foundations of Healing. And I think you're really going to like this program. It is a subject that we all need to know about, healing. I hope you have a great day, and make sure that you go to iTunes and leave us a review. Let me know what you think of the show. Let others know too. All right, take care.